she said. But some of us have taken off our blindfolds and see that there's nothing to see. It's a kind of salvation. The boy's astonished eyes looked blankly through the ends of her hair. Okay, he almost whined. But do you love me or don't you? Yes, she said and added, in a sense. But I must tell you something. There mustn't be anything dishonest between us. She lifted his head and looked him in the eye. I am 30 years old, she said. I have a number of degrees. The boy's look was irritated but dogged. I don't care, he said. I don't care a thing about what all you done. I just want to know if you love me or don't you. And he caught her to him and wildly planted her face with kisses until she said, Yes, yes. Okay, then, he said, letting her go. Prove it. She smiled, looking dreamily out on the shifty landscape. She had seduced him without even making up her mind to try. How? She asked, feeling that he should be delayed a little. He leaned over and put his lips to her ear. Show me where your wooden leg joins on, he whispered. The girl uttered a sharp little cry and her face instantly drained of color. The obscenity of the suggestion was not what shocked her. As a child, she had sometimes been subject to feelings of shame, but education had removed the last traces of that, as a good surgeon scrapes for cancer. She would no more have felt it over what he was asking than she would have believed in his Bible. But she was as sensitive about the artificial leg as a peacock about his tail. No one ever touched it but her. She took care of it as someone else would his soul, in private, and almost with her own eyes turned away. No, she said. I known it, he muttered, sitting up. You're just playing me for a sucker. Oh, no, no, she cried. It joins on at the knee. Only at the knee. Why do you want to see it? The boy gave her a long, penetrating look. Because, he said, it's what makes you different. You ain't like anybody else. She sat staring at him. There was nothing about her face or her round, freezing blue eyes to indicate that this had moved her. But she felt as if her heart had stopped and left her mind to pump her blood. She decided that for the first time in her life she was face to face with real innocence. This boy, with an instinct that came from beyond wisdom, had touched the truth about her. When, after a minute, she said in a hoarse, high voice, All right? It was like surrendering to him completely. It was like losing her own life and finding it again, miraculously, in his. Very gently, he began to roll the slack leg up. The artificial limb, in a white sock and brown flat shoe, was bound in a heavy material like canvas and ended in an ugly jointure where it was attached to the stump. The boy's face and his voice were entirely reverent as he uncovered it and said, Now, show me how to take it off and on. She took it off for him and put it back on again, and then he took it off himself, handling it as tenderly as if it were a real one. See? He said with a delighted child's face. Now I can do it myself. Put it back on, she said. She was thinking that she would run away with him and that every night he would take the leg off and every morning put it back on again. Put it back on, she said. Not yet, he murmured, setting it on its foot out of her reach. Leave it off for a while. You got me instead. She gave a little cry of alarm, but he pushed her down and began to kiss her again. Without the leg, she felt entirely dependent on him. Her brain seemed to have stopped thinking altogether and to be about some other function that it was not very good at. Different expressions raced back and forth over her face. Every now and then, the boy, his eyes like two steel spikes, would glance behind him where the leg stood. Finally, she pushed him off and said, Put it back on me now. Wait, he said. He leaned the other way and pulled the valise toward him and opened it. It had a pale blue spotted lining, and there were only two Bibles in it. He took one of these out and opened the cover of it. It was hollow and contained a pocket flask of whiskey, a pack of cards, and a small blue box with printing on it. He laid these out in front of her one at a time in an evenly spaced row, like one presenting offerings at the shrine of a goddess. He put the blue box in her hand. "This product to be used only for the prevention of disease," she read, and dropped it. The boy was unscrewing the top of the flask. He stopped and pointed with a smile to the deck of cards. It was not an ordinary deck, but one with an obscene picture on the back of each card. "Take a swig," he said, offering her the bottle first. He held it in front of her, but like one mesmerized, she did not move. Her voice when she spoke had an almost pleading sound. "Aren't you," she murmured, "aren't you just good country people?" The boy cocked his head. He looked as if he were just beginning to understand that she might be trying to insult him. "Yeah," he said, curling his lip slightly, "but it ain't held me back none. I'm as good as you any day in the week." "Give me my leg," she said. He pushed it farther away with his foot. "Come on now, let's begin to have us a good time," he said coaxingly. "We ain't got to know one another good yet." "Give me my leg," she screamed, and tried to lunge for it, but he pushed her down easily. "What's the matter with you all of a sudden?" he asked, frowning as he screwed the top on the flask and put it quickly back inside the Bible. "You just a while ago said you didn't believe in nothing. I thought you was some girl." Her face was almost purple. "You're a Christian," she hissed. "You're a fine Christian. You're just like them all. Say one thing and do another. You're a perfect Christian. You're..." The boy's mouth was set angrily. "I hope you don't think," he said in a lofty, indignant tone, "that I believe in that crap. I may sell Bibles, but I know which end is up, and I wasn't born yesterday, and I know where I'm going." "Give me my leg," she screeched. He jumped up so quickly that she barely saw him sweep the cards and the blue box back into the Bible and throw the Bible into the valise. She saw him grab the leg, and then she saw it for an instant slanted forlornly across the inside of the suitcase with a Bible at either side of its opposite ends. He slammed the lid shut and snatched up the valise and swung it down the hole and then stepped through himself. When all of him had passed but his head, he turned and regarded her with a look that no longer had any admiration in it. "I've gotten a lot of interesting things," he said. "One time I got a woman's glass eye this way. And you needn't to think you'll catch me, because Pointer ain't really my name. I use a different name at every house I call at and don't stay nowhere long. And I'll tell you another thing, Holger," he said, using the name as if he didn't think much of it. "You ain't so smart. I've been believing in nothing ever since I was born." And then the toast-colored hat disappeared down the hole, and the girl was left, sitting on the straw in the dusty sunlight. When she turned her churning face toward the opening, she saw his blue figure struggling successfully over the green speckled lake. Mrs. Hopewell and Mrs. Freeman, who were in the back pasture digging up onions, saw him emerge a little later from the woods and head across the meadow toward the highway. "Why, that looks like that nice, dull young man that tried to sell me a Bible yesterday," Mrs. Hopewell said, squinting. "He must have been selling them to the Negroes back in there. He was so simple," she said. "But I guess the world would be better off if we were all that simple." Mrs. Freeman's gaze drove forward and just touched him before he disappeared under the hill. Then she returned her attention to the evil-smelling onion shoot she was lifting from the ground. "Some can't be that simple," she said. "I know I never could." The Displaced Person. The peacock was following Mrs. Shortley up the road to the hill where she meant to stand. Moving one behind the other, they looked like a complete procession. Her arms were folded, and as she mounted the prominence, she might have been the giant wife of the countryside, come out at some sign of danger to see what the trouble was. She stood on two tremendous legs, with the grand self-confidence of a mountain, and rose, up narrowing bulges of granite, to two icy blue points of light that pierced forward, surveying everything. She ignored the white afternoon sun, which was creeping behind a ragged wall of cloud, as if it pretended to be an intruder, and cast her gaze down the red clay road that turned off from the highway. The peacock stopped just behind her, his tail, glittering green, gold, and blue in the sunlight, lifted just enough so that it would not touch the ground. It flowed out on either side like a floating train, and his head on the long blue reed-like neck was drawn back as if his attention were fixed in the distance on something no one else could see. Mrs. Shortley was watching a black car turn through the gate from the highway. Over by the tool shed, about 15 feet away, the two Negroes, Aster and Sulk, had stopped work to watch. They were hidden by a mulberry tree, but Mrs. Shortley knew they were there. Mrs. McIntyre was coming down the steps of her house to meet the car. She had on her largest smile, but Mrs. Shortley, even from her distance, could detect a nervous slide in it. These people who were coming were only hired help, like the Shortleys themselves, or the Negroes. Yet here was the owner of the place out to welcome them. Here she was, wearing her best clothes and a string of beads, and now bounding forward with her mouth stretched. The car stopped at the walk, just as she did, and the priest was the first to get out. He was a long-legged, black-suited old man with a white hat on, and a collar that he wore backwards, which Mrs. Shortley knew was what priests did who wanted to be known as priests. It was this priest who had arranged for these people to come here. He opened the back door of the car, and out jumped two children, a boy and a girl, and then, stepping more slowly, a woman in brown, shaped like a peanut. Then the front door opened, and out stepped the man, the displaced person. He was short and a little sway-backed, and wore gold-rimmed spectacles. Mrs. Shortley's vision narrowed on him, and then widened to include the woman and the two children in a group picture. The first thing that struck her as very peculiar was that they looked like other people. Every time she had seen them in her imagination, the image she had got was of the three bears walking single file, with wooden shoes on like Dutchmen and sailor hats and bright coats with a lot of buttons. But the woman had on a dress she might have worn herself, and the children were dressed like anybody from around. The man had on khaki pants and a blue shirt. Suddenly, as Mrs. McIntyre held out her hand to him, he bobbed down from the waist and kissed it. Mrs. Shortley jerked her own hand up toward her mouth, and then after a second brought it down and rubbed it vigorously on her seat. If Mr. Shortley had tried to kiss her hand, Mrs. McIntyre would have knocked him into the middle of next week. But then Mr. Shortley wouldn't have kissed her hand anyway. He didn't have time to mess around. She looked closer, squinting. The boy was in the center of the group, talking. He was supposed to speak the most English because he had learned some in Poland, and so he was to listen to his father's Polish and say it in English, and then listen to Mrs. McIntyre's English and say that in Polish. The priest had told Mrs. McIntyre his name was Rudolph and he was 12, and the girl's name was Sledgewig and she was 9. Sledgewig sounded to Mrs. Shortley like something you would name a bug, or vice versa if you named a boy Boll Weevil. All of them's last name was something that only they themselves and the priest could pronounce. All she could make out of it was Gobblehook. She and Mrs. McIntyre had been calling them the Gobblehooks all week while they got ready for them. There had been a great deal to do to get ready for them, because they didn't have anything of their own. Not a stick of furniture, or a sheet, or a dish. And everything had had to be scraped together out of things that Mrs. McIntyre couldn't use anymore, herself. They had collected a piece of odd furniture here and a piece there, and they had taken some flowered chicken feed sacks and made curtains for the windows, two red and one green, because they had not had enough of the red sacks to go around. Mrs. McIntyre said she was not made of money, and she could not afford to buy curtains. "They can't talk," Mrs. Shortley said. "You reckon they'll know what colors even is?" And Mrs. McIntyre had said that after what those people had been through, they should be grateful for anything they could get. She said to think how lucky they were to escape from over there and come to a place like this. Mrs. Shortley recalled a newsreel she had seen once of a small room, piled high with bodies of dead, naked people all in a heap, their arms and legs tangled together, a head thrust in here, a head there, a foot, a knee, a part that should have been covered up sticking out, a hand raised clutching nothing. Before you could realize that it was real and take it into your head, the picture changed and a hollow-sounding voice was saying, "Time marches on." This was the kind of thing that was happening every day in Europe, where they had not advanced as in this country, and watching from her vantage point, Mrs. Shortley had the sudden intuition that the gobblehooks, like rats with typhoid fleas, could have carried all those murderous ways over the water with them directly to this place. If they had come from where that kind of thing was done to them, who was to say they were not the kind that would also do it to others? The width and breadth of this question nearly shook her. Her stomach trembled, as if there had been a slight quake in the heart of the mountain, and automatically she moved down from her elevation and went forward to be introduced to them, as if she meant to find out at once what they were capable of. She approached, stomach foremost, head back, arms folded, boots flopping gently against her large legs. About 15 feet from the gesticulating group, she stopped and made her presence felt by training her gaze on the back of Mrs. McIntyre's neck. Mrs. McIntyre was a small woman of 60, with a round, wrinkled face and red bangs that came almost down to two high orange-colored penciled eyebrows. She had a little doll's mouth and eyes that were a soft blue when she opened them wide, but more like steel or granite when she narrowed them to inspect a milk can. She had buried one husband and divorced two, and Mrs. Shortley respected her as a person nobody had put anything over on yet, except, ha-ha, perhaps the Shortleys. She held out her arm in Mrs. Shortley's direction and said to the Rudolph boy, "And this is Mrs. Shortley. Mr. Shortley is my dairy man. Where's Mr. Shortley?" she asked as his wife began to approach again, her arms still folded. "I want him to meet the Guizacs." Now it was Guizac. She wasn't calling them gobblehook to their face. "Chancey's at the barn," Mrs. Shortley said. "He don't have time to rest himself in the bushes like them niggers over there." Her look first grazed the tops of the displaced people's heads, and then revolved downwards slowly, the way a buzzard glides and drops in the air until it alights on the carcass. She stood far enough away so that the man would not be able to kiss her hand. He looked directly at her with little green eyes, and gave her a broad grin that was toothless on one side. Mrs. Shortley, without smiling, turned her attention to the little girl who stood by the mother, swinging her shoulders from side to side. She had long braided hair and two looped pigtails, and there was no denying she was a pretty child, even if she did have a bug's name. She was better looking than either Annie Maud or Sarah May, Mrs. Shortley's two girls, gone on 15 and 17. But Annie Maud had never got her growth, and Sarah May had a cast in her eye. She compared the foreign boy to her son H.C., and H.C. came out far ahead. H.C. was 20 years old with her build and eyeglasses. He was going to Bible school now, and when he finished he was going to start him a church. He had a strong, sweet voice for hymns and could sell anything. Mrs. Shortley looked at the priest and was reminded that these people did not have an advanced religion. There was no telling what all they believed, since none of the foolishness had been reformed out of it. Again she saw the room piled high with bodies. The priest spoke in a foreign way himself. English, but as if he had a throat full of hay. He had a big nose and a bald rectangular face and head. While she was observing him, his large mouth dropped open, and with a stare behind her, he said, "Oh," and pointed. Mrs. Shortley spun around. The peacock was standing a few feet behind her, with his head slightly cocked.
"What a beautiful bird," the priest murmured.
"Another mouth to feed,"
Mrs. McIntyre said, glancing in the peafowl's direction.
"And when does he raise his splendid tail?" asked the priest.
"Just when it suits him," she said. "There used to be 20 or 30 of those things on the place, but I've let them die off. I don't like to hear them scream in the middle of the night."
"So beautiful," the priest said. "A tail full of suns,"
and he crept forward on tiptoe and looked down on the bird's back, where the polished gold and green design began. The peacock stood still as if he had just come down from some sun-drenched height to be a vision for them all. The priest's homely red face hung over him, glowing with pleasure. Mrs. Shortley's mouth had drawn acidly to one side.
"Nothing but a pea chicken," she muttered.
Mrs. McIntyre raised her orange eyebrows and exchanged a look with her to indicate that the old man was in his second childhood.
"Well, we must show the Guizacs their new home," she said impatiently, and she herded them into the car again.
The peacock stepped off toward the mulberry tree where the two Negroes were hiding, and the priest turned his absorbed face away and got in the car and drove the displaced people down to the shack they were to occupy. Mrs. Shortley waited until the car was out of sight, and then she made her way circuitously to the mulberry tree, and stood about 10 feet behind the two Negroes, one an old man holding a bucket half full of calf feed, and the other a yellowish boy with a short woodchuck-like head pushed into a rounded felt hat.
"Well," she said slowly, "y'all have looked long enough. What you think about them?"
The old man, Astor, raised himself.
"We been watching," he said, as if this would be news to her. "Who they now?"
"They come from over the water," Mrs. Shortley said with a wave of her arm. "They're what is called displaced persons."
"Displaced persons," he said. "Well, now, I declare. What do that mean?"
"It means they ain't where they were born at, and there's nowhere for them to go. Like if you was run out of here and wouldn't nobody have you."
"It seems like they're here, though,"
the old man said in a reflective voice.
"If they're here, they're somewhere."
"Sho is," the other agreed. "They're here."
The illogic of Negro thinking always irked Mrs. Shortley.
"They ain't where they belong to be at," she said. "They belong to be back over yonder where everything is still like they've been used to. Over here it's more advanced than where they come from. But y'all better look out now," she said, and nodded her head. "There's about 10 million billion more just like them, and I know what Mrs. McIntyre said."
"Say what?"
the young one asked.
"Places are not easy to get nowadays for white or black, but I reckon I heard what she stated to me," she said in a sing-song voice. "You liable to hear most anything,"
the old man remarked, leaning forward as if he were about to walk off but holding himself suspended.
"I heard her say this is gone put the fear of the Lord into those shiftless niggers,"
Mrs. Shortley said in a ringing voice. The old man started off.
"She says something like that every now and then," he said. "Ha ha, yes indeed. You better get on in that barn and help Mr. Shortley," she said to the other one. "What you reckon she pays you for?" "He the one sunk me out," the Negro muttered. "He the one give me something else to do." "Well, you better get to doing it then," she said, and stood there until he moved off.
Then she stood a while longer, reflecting, her unseeing eyes directly in front of the peacock's tail. He had jumped into the tree, and his tail hung in front of her, full of fierce planets with eyes that were each ringed in green,
and set against a sun that was gold in 1 second's light and salmon-colored in the next. She might have been looking at a map of the universe, but she didn't notice it any more than she did the spots of sky that cracked the dull green of the tree. She was having an inner vision instead. She was seeing the 10 million billion of them pushing their way into new places over here, and herself, a giant angel with wings as wide as a house, telling the Negroes that they would have to find another place. She turned herself in the direction of the barn, musing on this, her expression lofty and satisfied. She approached the barn from an oblique angle that allowed her a look in the door before she could be seen herself. Mr. Chansley Shortley was adjusting the last milking machine. On a large black-and-white spotted cow near the entrance, squatting at her heels. There was about a half-inch of cigarette adhering to the center of his lower lip. Mrs. Shortley observed it minutely for half a second. "If she seen or heard of you smoking in this barn, she would blow a fuse," she said. Mr. Shortley raised a sharply rutted face containing a washout under each cheek, and two long crevices eaten down both sides of his blistered mouth.
"You gon't be the one to tell her?"
he asked. "She's got a nose of her own," Mrs. Shortley said. Mr. Shortley, without appearing to give the feat any consideration, lifted the cigarette stub with the sharp end of his tongue, drew it into his mouth, closed his lips tightly, rose, stepped out, gave his wife a good round appreciative stare, and spit the smoldering butt into the grass. "Aw, Chancy," she said. "Aw, aw." And she dug a little hole for it with her toe and covered it up. This trick of Mr. Shortley's was actually his way of making love to her. When he had done his courting, he had not brought a guitar to strum or anything pretty for her to keep, but had sat on her porch steps, not saying a word, imitating a paralyzed man propped up to enjoy a cigarette. When the cigarette got the proper size, he would turn his eyes to her and open his mouth and draw in the butt and then sit there as if he had swallowed it, looking at her with the most loving look anybody could imagine. It nearly drove her wild, and every time he did it, she wanted to pull his hat down over his eyes and hug him to death. "Well," she said, going into the barn after him, "the gobblehooks have come, and she wants you to meet them. Says, 'Where's Mr. Shortley?' And I says, 'He don't have time.'" "Tote up them weights," Mr. Shortley said, squatting to the cow again. "You reckon he can drive a tractor when he don't know English?" she asked. "I don't think she's gonna get her money's worth out of them. That boy can talk, but he looks delicate. The one can work can't talk, and the one can talk can't work. She ain't any better off than if she had more niggers."
"I'd rather have a nigger if it was me," Mr. Shortley said.
"She says it's 10 million more like them, displaced persons. She says that their priest can get her all she wants."
"She better quit messing with that there priest," Mr. Shortley said.
"He don't look smart," Mrs. Shortley said. "Kind of foolish.
I ain't going to have the Pope of Rome tell me how to run no dairy," Mr. Shortley said.
"They ain't Italians, they're Poles," she said, "from Poland, where all them bodies were stacked up at. You remember all them bodies?"
"I'll give them 3 weeks here," Mr. Shortley said.
3 weeks later, Mrs. McIntyre and Mrs. Shortley drove to the Cane Bottom to see Mr. Guizac start to operate the silage cutter, a new machine that Mrs. McIntyre just bought because she said, for the first time, she had somebody who could operate it. Mr. Guizac could drive a tractor, use the rotary hay baler, the silage cutter, the combine, the Letts mill, or any other machine she had on the place. He was an expert mechanic, a carpenter, and a mason. He was thrifty and energetic. Mrs. McIntyre said she figured he would save her $20 a month on repair bills alone. She said getting him was the best day's work she had ever done in her life. He could work milking machines, and he was scrupulously clean. He did not smoke. She parked her car on the edge of the cane field, and they got out.
Sulk, the young Negro, was attaching the wagon to the cutter, and Mr. Guizac was attaching the cutter to the tractor. He finished first and pushed the colored boy out of the way and attached the wagon to the cutter himself, gesticulating with a bright, angry face when he wanted the hammer or the screwdriver. Nothing was done quick enough to suit him. The Negroes made him nervous. The week before, he had come upon Sulk at the dinner hour, sneaking with a croaker sack into the pen where the young turkeys were. He had watched him take a frying-sized turkey from the lot and thrust it in the sack and put the sack under his coat. Then he had followed him around the barn, jumped on him, dragged him to Mrs. McIntyre's back door, and had acted out the entire scene for her, while the Negro muttered and grumbled and said God might strike him dead if he had been stealing any turkey. He had only been taking it to put some black shoe polish on its head because it had the sore head. God might strike him dead if that was not the truth before Jesus. Mrs. McIntyre told him to go put the turkey back. And then she was a long time explaining to the Pole that all Negroes would steal. She finally had to call Rudolph and tell him in English, and have him tell his father in Polish, and Mr. Guizac had gone off with a startled, disappointed face. Mrs. Shortley stood by hoping there would be trouble with the silage machine, but there was none. All of Mr. Guizac's motions were quick and accurate. He jumped on the tractor like a monkey and maneuvered the big orange cutter into the cane. In a second, the silage was spurting in a green jet out of the pipe into the wagon. He went jolting down the row until he disappeared from sight, and the noise became remote. Mrs. McIntyre sighed with pleasure. "At last," she said, "I've got somebody I can depend on. For years I've been fooling with sorry people. Sorry people, poor white trash and niggers," she muttered. "They've drained me dry. Before you all came, I had Ringfields and Collins and Gerald's and Perkins and Pinkins and Herons and God knows what all else, and not a one of them left without taking something off this place that didn't belong to them, not a one." Mrs. Shortley could listen to this with composure, because she knew that if Mrs. McIntyre had considered her trash, they couldn't have talked about trashy people together. Neither of them approved of trash. Mrs. McIntyre continued with the monologue that Mrs. Shortley had heard oftentimes before. "I've been running this place for 30 years, she said, looking with a deep frown out over the field, "and always just barely making it. People think you're made of money. I have the taxes to pay, I have the insurance to keep up, I have the repair bills, I have the feed bills." It all gathered up, and she stood with her chest lifted and her small hands gripped around her elbows. "Ever since the judge died," she said, "I've barely been making ends meet, and they all take something when they leave. The niggers don't leave, they stay and steal. A nigger thinks anybody is rich he can steal from, and that white trash thinks anybody is rich who can afford to hire people, as sorry as they are. And all I've got is the dirt under my feet." "You hire and fire," Mrs. Shortley thought, but she didn't always say what she thought. She stood by and let Mrs. McIntyre say it all out to the end, but this time it didn't end as usual. "But at last I'm saved," Mrs. McIntyre said. "One fellow's misery is the other fellow's gain. That man there," and she pointed where the displaced person had disappeared, "he has to work. He wants to work." She turned to Mrs. Shortley with her bright, wrinkled face. "That man is my salvation," she said. Mrs. Shortley looked straight ahead as if her vision penetrated the cane and the hill and pierced through to the other side. "I would suspicion salvation got from the devil," she said in a slow, detached way. "Now what do you mean by that?" Mrs. McIntyre asked, looking at her sharply. Mrs. Shortley wagged her head but would not say anything else. The fact was she had nothing else to say, for this intuition had only at that instant come to her. She had never given much thought to the devil, for she felt that religion was essentially for those people who didn't have the brains to avoid evil without it. For people like herself, for people of gumption, it was a social occasion providing the opportunity to sing. But if she had ever given it much thought, she would have considered the devil the head of it and God the hanger-on. With the coming of these displaced people, she was obliged to give new thought to a good many things.
"I know what Sledgewig told Annie Maud," she said, and when Mrs. McIntyre carefully did not ask her what, but reached down and broke off a sprig of sassafras to chew, she continued in a way to indicate she was not telling all. "That they wouldn't be able to live long, the four of them, on $70 a month."
"He's worth raising," Mrs. McIntyre said. "He saves me money." This was as much as to say that Chancy had never saved her money. Chancy got up at 4 in the morning to milk her cows, in winter wind and summer heat, and he had been doing it for the last 2 years. They had been with her the longest she had ever had anybody. The gratitude they got was these hints that she hadn't been saved any money.
"Is Mr. Shortley feeling better today?" Mrs. McIntyre asked.
Mrs. Shortley thought it was about time she was asking that question. Mr. Shortley had been in bed 2 days with an attack. Mr. Grisak had taken his place in the dairy in addition to doing his own work. "No, he ain't," she said. "That doctor said he was suffering from overexhaustion."
"If Mr. Shortley is overexhausted," Mrs. McIntyre said, "then he must have a second job on the side."
And she looked at Mrs. Shortley with almost closed eyes, as if she were examining the bottom of a milk can. Mrs. Shortley did not say a word, but her dark suspicion grew like a black thundercloud. The fact was that Mr. Shortley did have a second job on the side, and that, in a free country, this was none of Mrs. McIntyre's business. Mr. Shortley made whiskey. He had a small still back in the farthest reaches of the place, on Mrs. McIntyre's land, to be sure, but on land that she only owned and did not cultivate, on idle land that was not doing anybody any good. Mr. Shortley was not afraid of work. He got up at 4 in the morning and milked her cows, and in the middle of the day, when he was supposed to be resting, he was off attending to his still. Not every man would work like that. The Negroes knew about his still, but he knew about theirs, so there had never been any disagreeableness between them. But with foreigners on the place, with people who were all eyes and no understanding, who had come from a place continually fighting, where the religion had not been reformed, with this kind of people, you had to be on the lookout every minute. She thought there ought to be a law against them. There was no reason they couldn't stay over there and take the places of some of the people who had been killed in their wars and butcherings. "What's furthermore," she said suddenly, "Sledgewig said as soon as her papa saved the money, he was going to buy him a used car. Once they get them a used car, they'll leave you."
"I can't pay him enough for him to save money," Mrs. McIntyre said. "I'm not worrying about that."
"Of course," she said then. "If Mr. Shortley got incapacitated, I would have to use Mr. Grisak in the dairy all the time, and I would have to pay him more." "He doesn't smoke," she said, and it was the 5th time within the week that she had pointed this out.
"It is no man," Mrs. Shortley said emphatically, "that works as hard as Chancy, or is as easy with a cow, or is more of a Christian." And she folded her arms, and her gaze pierced the distance. The noise of the tractor and cutter increased, and Mr. Grisak appeared coming around the other side of the cane row. "Which cannot be said about everybody," she muttered. She wondered whether, if the pole found Chancy's still, he would know what it was. The trouble with these people was you couldn't tell what they knew. Every time Mr. Grisak smiled, Europe stretched out in Mrs. Shortley's imagination. Mysterious and evil, the devil's experiment station. The tractor, the cutter, the wagon passed, rattling and rumbling and grinding before them.
"Think how long that would have taken with men and mules to do it," Mrs. McIntyre shouted. "We'll get this whole bottom cut within 2 days at this rate."
"Maybe," Mrs. Shortley muttered, "if don't no terrible accident occur." She thought how the tractor had made mules worthless. Nowadays you couldn't give away a mule. The next thing to go, she reminded herself, will be niggers.
In the afternoon, she explained what was going to happen to them, to Aster and Sulk, who were in the cow lot, filling the manure spreader. She sat down next to the block of salt under a small shed, her stomach in her lap, her arms on top of it.
"All you colored people better look out," she said. "You know how much you can get for a mule."
"Nothing, no indeed," the old man said. "Not one thing."
"Before it was a tractor," she said, "it could be a mule. And before it was a displaced person, it could be a nigger."
"The time is going to come," she prophesied, "when it won't be no more occasion to speak of a nigger."
The old man laughed politely.
"Yes, indeed," he said. "Ha ha."
The young one didn't say anything. He only looked sullen, but when she had gone in the house, he said,
"Big Belly act like she know everything."
"Never mind," the old man said. "Your place too low for anybody to dispute with you for it."
She didn't tell her fears about the still to Mr. Shortley until he was back on the job in the dairy. Then one night after they were in bed, she said,
"That man prowls."
Mr. Shortley folded his hands on his bony chest and pretended he was a corpse.
"Prowls," she continued, and gave him a sharp kick in the side with her knee. "Who's to say what they know and don't know? Who's to say if he found it, he wouldn't go right to her and tell? How you know they don't make liquor in Europe? They drive tractors. They got them all kinds of machinery. Answer me."
"Don't worry me now," Mr. Shortley said. "I'm a dead man."
"It's them little eyes of his that's foreign," she muttered. "And that way he's got of shrugging."
She drew her shoulders up and shrugged several times. "How come he's got anything to shrug about?" she asked.
"If everybody was as dead as I am, nobody would have no trouble," Mr. Shortley said.
"That priest," she muttered, and was silent for a minute. Then she said, "In Europe, they probably got some different way to make liquor, but I reckon they know all the ways. They're full of crooked ways. They never have advanced or reformed. They got the same religion as 1,000 years ago. It could only be the devil responsible for that, always fighting amongst each other, disputing, and then get us into it. Ain't they got us into it twice already, and we ain't got no more sense than to go over there and settle it for them, and then they come on back over here and snoop around and find your still and go straight to her, and liable to kiss her hand any minute. Do you hear me?"
"No,"
Mr. Shortley said. "And I'll tell you another thing," she said. "I wouldn't be at all surprised if he don't know everything you say, whether it be in English or not."
"I don't speak no other language," Mr. Shortley murmured.
"I suspect," she said, "that before long there won't be no more niggers on this place, and I'll tell you what, I'd rather have niggers than them Poles, and what's furthermore, I aim to take up for the niggers when the time comes. When Gobblehook first come here, you recollect how he shook their hands like he didn't know the difference, like he might have been as black as them. But when it come to finding out Sulk was taking turkeys, he gone on and told her. I known he was taking turkeys. I could have told her myself."
Mr. Shortley was breathing softly as if he were asleep.
"A nigger don't know when he has a friend," she said. "And I'll tell you another thing. I get a heap out of Sledgewig. Sledgewig said that in Poland, they lived in a brick house, and one night a man come and told them to get out of it before daylight. Do you believe they ever lived in a brick house?"
"Airs," she said. "That's just airs. A wooden house is good enough for me."
"Chancy," she said, "turn this away. I hate to see niggers mistreated and run out. I have a heap of pity for niggers and poor folks. Ain't I always had?" she asked. "I say, ain't I always been a friend to niggers and poor folks? When the time comes," she said, "I'll stand up for the niggers, and that's that. I ain't going to see that priest drive out all the niggers."
Mrs. McIntyre bought a new drag harrow and a tractor with a power lift, because she said for the first time She had someone who could handle machinery. She and Mrs. Shortley had driven to the back field to inspect what he had harrowed the day before.
"That's been done beautifully," Mrs. McIntyre said, looking out over the red, undulating ground. Mrs. McIntyre had changed since the displaced person had been working for her, and Mrs. Shortley had observed the change very closely. She had begun to act like somebody who was getting rich secretly, and she didn't confide in Mrs. Shortley the way she used to. Mrs. Shortley suspected that the priest was at the bottom of the change. They were very slick. First he would get her into his church, and then he would get his hand in her pocketbook. Well, Mrs. Shortley thought, the more fool she. Mrs. Shortley had a secret herself. She knew something the displaced person was doing that would floor.
"I still say he ain't going to work forever for $70 a month," she murmured. She intended to keep her secret to herself and Mr. Shortley.
"Well," Mrs. McIntyre said, "I may have to get rid of some of this other help so I can pay him more."
Mrs. Shortley nodded to indicate she had known this for some time. "I'm not saying those niggers ain't had it coming," she said, "but they do the best they know how. You can always tell a nigger what to do and stand by until he does it."
"That's what the judge said," Mrs. McIntyre said, and looked at her with approval.
The judge was her first husband, the one who had left her the place. Mrs. Shortley had heard that she had married him when she was 30 and he was 75, thinking she would be rich as soon as he died. But the old man was a scoundrel, and when his estate was settled, they found he didn't have a nickel. All he left her were the 50 acres in the house. But she always spoke of him in a reverent way, and quoted his sayings such as, "One fella's misery is the other fella's gain," and, "The devil you know is better than the devil you don't."
"However," Mrs. Shortley remarked, "the devil you know is better than the devil you don't."
And she had to turn away so that Mrs. McIntyre would not see her smile. She had found out what the displaced person was up to through the old man, Astor, and she had not told anybody but Mr. Shortley. Mr. Shortley had risen straight up in bed like Lazarus from the tomb.
"Shut your mouth," he had said.
"Yes," she had said.
"No,"
Mr. Shortley had said. "Yes," she had said. Mr. Shortley had fallen back flat.
"The pole don't know any better," Mrs. Shortley had said. "I reckon that priest is putting him up to it is all. I blame the priest."
The priest came frequently to see the Guizacs, and he would always stop in and visit Mrs. McIntyre, too, and they would walk around the place, and she would point out her improvements and listen to his rattling talk. It suddenly came to Mrs. Shortley that he was trying to persuade her to bring another Polish family onto the place. With two of them here, there would be almost nothing spoken but Polish. The Negroes would be gone, and there would be the two families against Mr. Shortley and herself. She began to imagine a war of words, to see the Polish words and the English words coming at each other, stalking forward, not sentences, just words, gabble, 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 flung out high and shrill and stalking forward, and then grappling with each other. She saw the Polish words, dirty and all-knowing and unreformed, flinging mud on the clean English words until everything was equally dirty. She saw them all piled up in a room, all the dead, dirty words, theirs and hers too, piled up like the naked bodies in the newsreel.
"God save me," she cried silently, "from the stinking power of Satan."
And she started from that day to read her Bible with a new attention. She pored over the Apocalypse and began to quote from the prophets, and before long she had come to a deeper understanding of her existence. She saw plainly that the meaning of the world was a mystery that had been planned, and she was not surprised to suspect that she had a special part in the plan because she was strong. She saw that the Lord God Almighty had created the strong people to do what had to be done, and she felt that she would be ready when she was called. Right now she felt that her business was to watch the priest. His visits irked her more and more. On the last one, he went about picking up feathers off the ground. He found 2 peacock feathers and 4 or 5 turkey feathers and an old brown hen feather and took them off with him like a bouquet. This foolish acting did not deceive Mrs. Shortley any. Here he was leading foreigners over in hordes to places that were not theirs, to cause disputes, to uproot niggers, to plant the whore of Babylon in the midst of the righteous. Whenever he came on the place, she hid herself behind something and watched until he left. It was on a Sunday afternoon that she had her vision. She had gone to drive in the cows for Mr. Shortley, who had a pain in his knee, and she was walking slowly through the pasture, her arms folded, her eyes on the distant low-lying clouds that looked like rows and rows of white fish washed up on a great blue beach. She paused after an incline to heave a sigh of exhaustion, for she had an immense weight to carry around, and she was not as young as she used to be. At times she could feel her heart, like a child's fist, clenching and unclenching inside her chest. And when the feeling came, it stopped her thought altogether, and she would go about like a large hull of herself, moving for no reason. But she gained this incline without a tremor, and stood at the top of it, pleased with herself. Suddenly, while she watched, the sky folded back in 2 pieces like the curtain to a stage, and a gigantic figure stood facing her. It was the color of the sun in the early afternoon, white gold. It was of no definite shape, but there were fiery wheels with fierce, dark eyes in them, spinning rapidly all around it. She was not able to tell if the figure was going forward or backward, because its magnificence was so great. She shut her eyes in order to look at it, and it turned blood red, and the wheels turned white. A voice, very resonant, said the one word, "Prophecy." She stood there, tottering slightly but still upright, her eyes shut tight, and her fists clenched, and her straw sun hat low on her forehead. "The children of wicked nations will be butchered," she said in a loud voice. "Legs where arms should be, foot to face, ear in the palm of hand. Who will remain whole? Who will remain whole? Who?" Presently she opened her eyes. The sky was full of white fish, carried lazily on their sides by some invisible current, and pieces of the sun, submerged some distance beyond them, appeared from time to time, as if they were being washed in the opposite direction. Woodenly she planted one foot in front of the other until she had crossed the pasture and reached the lot. She walked through the barn like one in a daze, and did not speak to Mr. Shortley. She continued up the road until she saw the priest's car, parked in front of Mrs. McIntyre's house. "Here again," she muttered, "come to destroy." Mrs. McIntyre and the priest were walking in the yard. In order not to meet them face to face, she turned to the left and entered the feed house, a single-room shack piled on one side with flowered sacks of scratch feed. There were spilled oyster shells in one corner, and a few old dirty calendars on the wall, advertising calf feed and various patent medicine remedies. One showed a bearded gentleman in a frock coat holding up a bottle, and beneath his feet was the inscription, "I have been made regular by this marvelous discovery." Mrs. Shortley had always felt close to this man, as if he were some distinguished person she was acquainted with, but now her mind was on nothing but the dangerous presence of the priest. She stationed herself at a crack between 2 boards, where she could look out and see him and Mrs. McIntyre strolling toward the turkey brooder, which was placed just outside the feed house. "Arr," he said as they approached the brooder. "Look at the little biddies." And he stooped and squinted through the wire. Mrs. Shortley's mouth twisted. "Do you think the Guizacs will want to leave me?" Mrs. McIntyre asked. "Do you think they'll go to Chicago, or some place like that?"
"And why should they do that now?"
asked the priest, wiggling his finger at a turkey, his big nose close to the wire. "Money," Mrs. McIntyre said.
Ah, give them some R, then,
he said indifferently.
They have to get along.
So do I, Mrs. McIntyre muttered. It means I'm going to have to get rid of some of these others.
And are the Shortleys satisfactory?
He inquired, paying more attention to the turkeys than to her.
5 times in the last month I've found Mr. Shortley smoking in the barn, Mrs. McIntyre said. 5 times.
And are the Negroes any better?
They lie and steal and have to be watched all the time, she said.
Tisk, tisk,
he said.
Which will you discharge?
I've decided to give Mr. Shortley his month's notice tomorrow, Mrs. McIntyre said.
The priest scarcely seemed to hear her, he was so busy wiggling his finger inside the wire. Mrs. Shortley sat down on an open sack of laying mash with a dead thump that sent feed dust clouding up around her. She found herself looking straight ahead at the opposite wall, where the gentleman on the calendar was holding up his marvelous discovery, but she didn't see him. She looked ahead as if she saw nothing whatsoever. Then she rose and ran to her house. Her face was an almost volcanic red. She opened all the drawers and dragged out boxes and old battered suitcases from under the bed. She began to unload the drawers into the boxes, all the time without pause, without taking off the sun hat she had on her head. She set the 2 girls to doing the same. When Mr. Shortley came in, she did not even look at him, but merely pointed one arm at him while she packed with the other.
"Bring the car around to the back door," she said. "You ain't waiting to be fired."
Mr. Shortley had never in his life doubted her omniscience. He perceived the entire situation in 1/2 a second and, with only a sour scowl, retreated out the door and went to drive the automobile around to the back. They tied the 2 iron beds to the top of the car and the 2 rocking chairs inside the beds and rolled the 2 mattresses up between the rocking chairs. On top of this, they tied a crate of chickens. They loaded the inside of the car with the old suitcases and boxes, leaving a small space for Annie Maud and Sarah May. It took them the rest of the afternoon and 1/2 the night to do this, but Mrs. Shortley was determined that they would leave before 4 o'clock in the morning, that Mr. Shortley should not adjust another milking machine on this place. All the time she had been working, her face was changing rapidly from red to white and back again. Just before dawn, as it began to drizzle rain, they were ready to leave. They all got in the car and sat there cramped up between boxes and bundles and rolls of bedding. The square black automobile moved off with more than its customary grinding noises, as if it were protesting the load. In the back, the 2 long, bony, yellow-haired girls were sitting on a pile of boxes, and there was a beaglehound puppy and a cat with 2 kittens somewhere under the blankets. The car moved slowly, like some over-freighted leaking ark, away from their shack and past the White House, where Mrs. McIntyre was sleeping soundly, hardly guessing that her cows would not be milked by Mr. Shortley that morning, and past the Pole's shack on the top of the hill, and on down the road to the gate where the 2 Negroes were walking, one behind the other, on their way to help with the milking. They looked straight at the car and its occupants, but even as the dim yellow headlights lit up their faces, they politely did not seem to see anything, or anyhow to attach significance to what was there. The loaded car might have been passing mist in the early morning half-light. They continued up the road at the same even pace without looking back. A dark yellow sun was beginning.